Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an agreement just reached in Geneva between the foreign ministers of the US, Russia, the EU and Ukraine that may at least temporarily end the crisis in Ukraine and bring Russia and Ukraine back from the brink of a shooting war. John Quigley, who has dealt with conflicts between Russia and Ukraine on behalf of the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, the same organization who are now supposed to oversee and monitor this agreement, joins us to examine the agreement. He is a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University and was a research scholar at Moscow State University. And we will look into who will disarm those occupying the buildings and whether Putin, who broke the 1994 Budapest Agreement when he took over Crimea, will live up to this agreement. Then we'll assess the backlash and unintended consequences of Putin's intimidation of Ukraine with Dr. Howard Hall, the Oak Ridge National Laboratory Governor's Chair in Nuclear Security, and Natalie Menieva, Research Assistant in the Institute for Nuclear Security at the University of Tennessee. They have an article at CNN, "Is Ukraine About to Go Nuclear Again?" And we will discuss whether, since two of Ukraine's political parties, Strike and Fatherland, have introduced a bill in Parliament to revoke the country's 1994 signature to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, Ukraine will follow Putin's advice in his New York Times message to the American people that, if you cannot count on international law, then you must find other ways to ensure your security. If you have the bomb, nobody will touch you. Then finally, we will speak with Dan Fagan, who just won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction for his new book, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. We will discuss this superb scientific detective story and great example of investigative journalism about corporate greed, government neglect, and courageous citizens who refused to keep silent until the truth was exposed about who and what was causing cancer clusters in a New Jersey seaside town. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking with Dan Fagan, who just won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction for his new book, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. And joining us now is John Quigley, who is a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University and previously a research scholar at Moscow State University and a research associate in comparative law at Harvard Law School. He has dealt with conflicts between Ukraine and Russia after the breakup of the USSR on behalf of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and his books include Basic Laws on the Structure of the Soviet State, Law After Revolution, and The Ruses of War, American Interventionism Since World War II. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Quigley.
Thank you very much.
And the agreement that has apparently been reached in Geneva between the foreign ministers of the U.S., the European Union, Russia, and Ukraine have agreed to de-escalate the crisis in Ukraine. And although we don't have a lot of specifics at this point, but they're talking about amnesty for all anti-government protesters, and these steps that they've agreed to will be overseen by monitors from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the group that you've worked with, John. Are you confident that this has successfully de-escalated this crisis? Because yesterday it looked like it was such a tinderbox that at any moment Russia and Ukraine could go to war.
Yes, I think it has, at least for now, de-escalated the conflict and eliminated the possibility of any flare-up of a significant kind in the short term. Whether it will hold in the long term is another question. But at least for now, it's a very hopeful sign in that it does seem to reflect the view of all the major parties that steps can be taken that will mean that there's not going to be a flare-up.
But at this point, Russia is the winner in as much as it has gotten away with annexing Crimea. It's made a mockery of the 1994 Budapest Memorandum, and it has, you know, I don't know what you can say about scared the dickens out of the government in Kiev that's basically barely formed and is about to get some legitimacy in assuming the May 25th elections take place. So, and just before this agreement was reached, Putin on national television in a call-in show in Russia said it is his right and it's Russia's right to move into Ukraine. So how much of those threats are off the table now?
Well, this would seem to mean that, at least in the short term, Mr. Putin is not planning to act on that statement that he made on that program. But I think you're right that this statement does implicitly acknowledge Russia's position in Crimea. It's a statement, actually, that doesn't say anything about what Russia will or will not do. It doesn't say anything about what the United States will or will not do, or what the European Union will or will not do. It's entirely about the domestic situation in Ukraine. But I think it carries a strong implication that the West is not going to ratchet up sanctions, and that Russia is not going to move troops into Ukraine. But it does, I think, by not mentioning Crimea, also indicate that that the West is at least accepting, if it doesn't like it, perhaps, but at least accepting Russia's position in Crimea.
And the other aspect, of course, of Putin's call-in, apart from the fact that Edward Snowden called into the show, which doesn't seem like an accident, and asked an extraordinarily softball question about whether Russia has surveillance over its citizens like the Americans do. But Putin did admit that the little green men, as the Ukrainians call it, that invaded Ukraine were in fact Russians, which is something he hadn't admitted to before. So how do you navigate around the kind of the cynical use of the truth on the part of Vladimir Putin?
Well, I mean, you can't anticipate complete honesty in all of these things. The agreement does have a provision. Well, I don't know if I should call it an agreement. The joint statement coming out of Geneva today says that all illegal armed groups must be disarmed. I think that is a reference, although it doesn't say it, you know, to the people you're talking about in Ukraine. And while it doesn't say who is supposed to disarm them, I think it's suggested that it would be Russia. Whether that will happen, I don't know.
But it also says that these actions will be monitored by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. So how long is that going to take? I mean, in other words, you're suggesting that Putin, since the so-called political tourists, and apparently there are a lot of Russian intelligence agents already in eastern Ukraine, that they're going to step down before the OSCE comes in?
Well, there's nothing about timing in this joint statement. So, but it says that the OSCE is to assist Ukrainian authorities and the local communities in the implementation of the de-escalation measures, and I'm not sure exactly what local communities means, whether that can be a reference to, I wouldn't think it would be a reference to the groups that are sponsored by Russia. But there are, in Ukraine, as we've seen over the last couple of days, a lot of local people who are very upset about the fact that the Ukrainian army has moved into that territory, and that the government in Kiev has characterized it as an anti-terrorist operation. And so that's what I think the OSCE is going to be monitoring to make sure that there are no confrontations between the Ukrainian army and local communities.
Well, not only that, and that doesn't appear to have been particularly effective on the part of the government in Kiev, that incursion. But, you know, the argument is, of course, that they didn't have any choice. If they were to roll over like they did in Crimea, they would have simply have given up eastern Ukraine. But the fact that there was local resistance indicates to me that this government in Kiev has got a lot of work to do to win over its own citizens in the east.
I think that's very clear. And that's something that perhaps the OSCE can facilitate. The OSCE has been involved in Ukraine for quite some time, and a lot of its people are quite familiar with the situation. So the Ukrainian government does have a real problem about winning the, if not the affection, at least the acquiescence of the population in eastern Ukraine. the fact that the parliament immediately after it threw out Mr. Yanukovych, passed a law on languages that was unfavorable to the use of Russian as an official language. That was a major mistake, I think, which the government realized within a couple of days and went
right,
back
and,
on
and,
it.
And Lavrov just brought it up again in Geneva.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, what Kerry brought up, I think, is pretty grim, and I was reading about this yesterday, that these masked pro-Russian gunmen were confronting Jewish worshippers coming out of synagogues on Passover in eastern Ukraine, telling them that they had to get an ID number and declare themselves citizens and pay a fee. And Kerry brought up this grotesque idea of what was happening there, of the Jews in the east of Ukraine have to register themselves as being Jewish, which is a flashback to the Nazis. And that's the very rhetoric that Putin and company have been accusing the Ukrainian government in Kiev of, when yet it's happening on there by being done by Russian surrogates.
Well, I'm not sure about the facts of that, so I can't comment on it. I'm not sure that I except what Mr. Kerry is saying about who is doing that. I mean, he may be correct, but it sounds so out of character for what's going on there that I find it a bit hard to think that it actually happened that way.
Well, the pamphlets themselves that were handed out to the Jewish worshippers leaving synagogues on Passover have been widely displayed on the internet, so the content is not up for question. I guess the extent of the anti-Semitism is where the question is, right?
Well, and who's behind it?
But the Russian propaganda that this whole government in Kiev are a bunch of fascists and anti-Semites, that's clearly overblown.
It is overblown, but there is some truth in it, unfortunately, and that's part of what needs to be worked out in this process that this joint statement is calling for. It calls for a constitutional process, transparent and accountable, for a broad national dialogue with outreach to all of Ukraine's regions and political constituencies. And that's not going to be easy to do. By any means, but I think the people in the East have to be convinced that those what are being called neo-fascist tendencies are at least marginal.
Well, that's always puzzled me from the beginning, why this government in Kiev, even though it's a temporary government, does have a disproportionate number of these right-wing ultra-nationalists in their government. But I guess the paradox of all this, surely, John Quigley, is that Putin's actions have, in fact, stimulated nationalism and a nationalistic backlash, both in Ukraine and in the Baltics. So, this is a direct consequence, I think, of this notion of the big power to the east intimidating these former Soviet republics.
Well, the main thing that Russia has done so far is to accept Crimea into its territory. And that, I think, is something on which it's rather difficult to fault Mr. Putin. This is something that was widely called for by the population of Crimea. There's a long history there of its affiliation with Russia. So I think that there's been a bit too much read into that.
Well, clearly, as you pointed out earlier, the U.S. has accepted it and the West has accepted it. But that's not to say that agreements reached on territorial integrity and respecting territorial integrity, as was reached in the 1994 Budapest Memorandum, is that to say they're worthless? That the Ukrainians aren't too happy about losing this territory.
That's true. They're not happy about it at all. And they did have that Budapest memorandum that you're referring to. The United States, I should point out, does not consider that to be a firm obligation. It does not consider
right.
it a treaty.
Sure.
So it's backed off it somewhat.
Right. And if Ukraine were a member of NATO, I don't think there's much the U.S. would have done. They're not going to go to war over Crimea. But in terms of international law, which is your background after all, John Quigley, this is not how nations are supposed to behave, is it? Just abrogate agreements, whether they're memoranda or treaties?
Well, you know, when a statement is put out, I mean, like this joint statement today in Geneva, it's not considered something that binds in the way a treaty does, although... Yeah, you know, you can certainly say it's bad faith when you sign on to something that looks like it's an agreement and then you don't carry through with it.
Which then leads us to be cautious about this agreement, surely.
Oh yes, for sure. And this isn't really an agreement. It's a statement of what the parties hope will happen in Ukraine.
Right. Well, let's hope it's more than that. And I thank you very much for joining us here today, John Quigley.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with John Quigley. He's a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University and previously a research scholar at Moscow State University and a research associate in comparative law at Harvard Law School. He has dealt with conflicts between Ukraine and Russia after the breakup of the USSR on behalf of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And his books include Basic Laws on the Structure of the Soviet State, Law After Revolution, and The Ruses of War, American Interventionism Since World War II. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into whether or not Ukraine will go nuclear again.
But the atoms here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Howard Hall, who's the director of the University of Tennessee's Institute for Nuclear Security and Oak Ridge National Laboratory Governor's Chair in Nuclear Security, and Natalie Manieva, who is a research assistant at the University of Tennessee's Institute for Nuclear Security. They have an article at CNN, Is Ukraine About to Go Nuclear Again? And of course, Dr. Howard Hall, that's a long-term prospect, and it could be the ultimate backlash from Putin taking Crimea and threatening eastern Ukraine. But at the moment, there appears to be at least some good news coming out of Geneva, where the foreign ministers of Russia, the U.S., and the European Union and Ukraine have agreed to steps to de-escalate the crisis. Are you confident that this agreement will hold?
Well, I'm certainly hopeful that it holds. The situation in Ukraine has the potential, as we noted in that article, to drastically undermine one of the principal tenets of global security, which is the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. And so if we can walk back from that brink through diplomatic channels, that is wonderful news. Hopefully it's an agreement that is both effective and sustainable.
And Natalie Manieva, what's your sense of the agreement, given that it's been pretty clear that Putin has been both the arsonist and the fire brigade in destabilizing the eastern Ukraine after having taken Crimea? He doesn't appear to want these May 25th elections to go ahead, because that will legitimize or at least produce a legitimate government in Kiev. So are you hopeful or skeptical?
Well, I guess both. Of course, all of us have to be hopeful in terms of that the new agreements will tone down the violence and help Ukraine and Russia to reach an agreement. But there are several problems within this. First of all, we know that the Russian government and Putin are not being very open and honest about the actions that they're doing in Ukraine. It was just several days ago that Mr. Putin for the first time acknowledged that people in military uniforms who were present in Crimea for a long time, by now over a month, are actually Russian military. If you remember, he was giving several interviews in terms of crisis, and he was saying that we do not know who those people are, it's not Russian military, and we have nothing to do with it. Yesterday, in an interview to Russian media, he actually acknowledged that, yes, those people were Russian troops.
Well, let me ask Dr. Howard Hall about the article that you've written it for at CNN, Is Ukraine About to Go Nuclear Again? And it reveals some alarming talk, which I didn't realize had been going on, and most people don't, that two of Ukraine's leading political parties, Fatherland and Strike, have introduced a bill in Parliament that calls for the rejection of the country's 1999 agreement to the 1968 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And further to that, Mustafa Dezimilov, who is a member of the Ukrainian Parliament since 1988, apparently he recently spoke with Putin and told him that because of Russia's breaking the Budapest Memorandum of 1994, that, quoting, such arrangements will not be trusted by anyone anymore, and that each country that has financial capacity to acquire its own nuclear weapons will be aspired to go down that path, and Ukraine is no exception. How credible should we take that possibility? Obviously, they've got a lot of, I think they've got 15 nuclear power plants operating in that country. They presumably have access to bomb fuel. They've had nuclear weapons. The nuclear weapons, I think, were built in Russia itself or the former Soviet Union. So what's your understanding of how quickly they could go nuclear?
Well, I think one of the good parts of this story is certainly Ukraine has, as you mentioned, 15 operating light water reactors. They also have the shutdown plutonium production reactor complex at Chernobyl. So their immediate access to nuclear material is limited. So if they were to try to develop the actual technology and implement a weapons program, they've got a bit of effort ahead of them. One of the things that is fortuitous and is reflective of some of the good work that has gone on in the nonproliferation field over the last few years. Just last year, the U.S. and Russia and Ukraine worked together to remove several hundred kilograms of highly enriched uranium from Ukraine and return it to Russia. Had that not occurred last year under the Global Threat Reduction Initiative, Ukraine would have the material in hand, and so the breakout time frame to go from a political decision that nuclear weapons are in the interest of the Ukrainian government to the actual ability to implement it could have been as short as a couple of weeks. And so we have, through the patient and prudent investments in threat reduction in the past, we have actually helped this situation quite substantially. So that is a very positive outcome of prior work on threat reduction. From the perspective of the strength of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, even if Ukraine is incapable of moving in any sort of timely or credible manner towards a nuclear weapons capability, the mere act of withdrawing from the NPT under this sort of territorial duress at the hands of a nuclear weapon state really does undermine the global norm. And so that's one of the main concerns here. It's not so much what happens in Ukraine, but what does the message that the Ukrainian situation presents to other nations that have the potential to go nuclear and may on any given day be thinking about what is the calculus for their national interest. And so that's one of the major concerns.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Howard Hall, who's the director of the University of Tennessee's Institute for Nuclear Security and Oak Ridge National Laboratory Governor's Chair in Nuclear Security, and Natalie Manieva, who is a research assistant at the University of Tennessee's Institute for Nuclear Security. They have an article at CNN, Is Ukraine About to Go Nuclear Again? And Natalie, in many ways, this situation is largely, you could in effect argue that Putin has hoisted himself on his own petard because of his New York Times opinion piece of September the 1st, largely about Syria, in which Putin himself said, if you cannot count on international law, then you must find other ways to ensure your security. This is logical. If you have the bomb, no one will touch you. So how much do you think this situation has backfired on Putin?
Well, I think it's a very interesting question, and I think we need to remember that Putin's foreign policy right now is not just his personal position. Unfortunately, we need to acknowledge that Putin's actions reflect deeply rooted sentiments among the Russian people. If you follow the public opinion polls from Russia, today more than 80% of people in Russia support Putin's actions in Ukraine, and they support him as a leader. So it's not just his personal decision to invade Ukraine because he thought it was a very good opportunity, but it's also a reflection of what the Russian people want and support. And he's just using and skillfully manipulating the public opinion to strengthen his own power in Russia.
But isn't he?
Yes, I think, Ian, one of the things that is, you know, a dilemma in this situation is for the rest of the world, this is a foreign policy challenge, if not disaster, but for Putin domestically, this has been a significant win.
Why? But to what extent, though, is he cynically tapping into a collective sense of humiliation that Russians feel after having been a superpower one day and then the next day, you know, asking for international aid? You know, in many ways, you can argue that the entire Russia itself is in a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder situation, and that Putin is cynically tapping into that to distract people from his own domestic looting that apparently is going on. He's apparently makes Yanukovych look like a small-time crook. So there are two ways to look at it. I mean, one cannot discount what Natalie just said, though. I'm not suggesting we should.
You are absolutely right, and both of those things need to be taken into consideration. From one perspective, the reasons why Putin was so popular from the first time when he was elected in 1999 is because he knows how to address and talk to Russian people and tap into those sentiments, because they felt humiliated, because they felt left out after the collapse of the former Soviet Union, and he knows really well how to use those public sentiments. That is from one point. From the other perspective, you're absolutely right when you're saying that his actions and his foreign policy right now in Syria and then in Ukraine, he's trying to distract the Russian public from tremendous economic problems that they're facing. The corruption is skyrocketing. They don't have good roads. The salaries are very low. They have so many social and political issues. And the best way how Putin can deal with it is to distract public attention by having military action and by having a war.
But Dr. Howard Hall, everything that Natalie just told us applies to Ukraine as well, does it not? In fact, Ukraine arguably is even more of an economic basket case. Russia had just had to downgrade its expectations of growth from 3% to zero growth, but it still has considerable resources. It does look as though Ukraine, though, is pretty much a basket case, isn't it?
Well, I think both Ukraine and Russia are struggling economically. And much of that economic struggle is also being reflected in political unrest. Now, Putin is masterfully manipulating both the Russian media and Russian popular opinion to maintain his grip on power. Yanukovych didn't do so well. And so the chaos in Ukraine, I think, is going to continue for a while. Delaying the establishment of some sort of legitimacy in the Ukrainian government in Kiev, I'm not sure is going to help the matter. So hopefully this deal that's been worked out will help get some clarity there. You know, this issue of corruption is significant. As you mentioned, the Russian press never talks about issues of corruption or, Putin's riches. But as you said, he does make the former Ukrainian president look like a tiger.
Well, let me ask Natalie then, in terms of the article that you've both written at CNN, is Ukraine about to go nuclear again? That, of course, is speculation based upon the notion of backlash and unintended consequences. And it would seem to me that one of the unintended consequences in terms of what Putin has done is to alarm the Baltic states, obviously Ukraine. But my understanding, even in Lukashenko's Belarus, they're getting nervous. So has Putin created a kind of nationalistic backlash in these former Soviet republics to the west of him?
I think this is a very important question, and we need to discuss the unintended consequences of Putin's action, both in Baltic republics and in former Soviet Union countries that are leaning to the west and those that are leaning to the east. You were absolutely right when you said the Baltic republics, Czech Republic, Poland, they're all alarmed. And what Putin is doing right now is going to push them to stay with the west and to stay with their western allies. But the problem is with other former Soviet Union countries, such as Belarus, Kazakhstan, Moldova, and other, the reaction in those countries and the consequences are going to be the opposite from what Western politicians and Western media is expecting. Because we think, based on the events that is going on in Ukraine, that people in those countries, such as Belarus, Moldova, and others, will be inspired and will want democratization. But as public opinion polls from Belarus and from other countries are demonstrating, people in those countries are scared of chaos that happened in Ukraine a month ago. Public opinion polls from Belarus are saying that only 3.6% of Belarusians want to see the same events happening in Minsk as what happened in Kiev. People in those countries want order. They want stability. And they were seeing the events, the revolution that happened in Ukraine through the lens of the Russian mass media that were portraying them as chaos, as mass murdering, as nationalistic and fascist events. So both governments in those countries are going to be strengthening the grip on society, and the public opinion in those countries are going to be having the opposite consequences from what the West is expecting.
So in other words, this is all going to play into Lukashenko's hands.
Absolutely.
This kind of Stalinist relic that runs Belarus.
Absolutely.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Howard Hall, again, co-author with Natalie Manieva of this article at CNN we're talking about here, is Ukraine about to go nuclear again? Given that that's a long-term possibility, which we have discussed, in the short term, though, what's your sense of whether or not that the agreements that have just been announced out of Geneva may solve the immediate crisis? But there's so many long-term problems here that are inherent in this situation, and it's unlikely that Putin is going to suddenly become a nice guy.
Well, I think the resolution of this crisis is principally in Putin's hands. I think the ability of the U.S. and the European Union and the somewhat dysfunctional government in Kiev to influence his decision-making is pretty limited right now. As we mentioned, he's right now riding a very, very strong wave of popular support at home, domestically. So he really faces no blowback in country. If he has reached the point where he's content, then hopefully this situation we will have the time for this to resolve in a peaceful manner. But that really is going to be a calculus that only Putin can see all of the variables on.
Well, Dr. Howard Hall, I thank you for joining us, and Natalie Manieva, I also thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Howard Hall, who is the director of the University of Tennessee's Institute for Nuclear Security and Oak Ridge National Laboratory Governor's Chair in Nuclear Security, and Natalie Manieva, who is Research Assistant at the University of Tennessee's Institute for Nuclear Security. They have an article at CNN, Is Ukraine About to Go Nuclear Again?
Ourselves divided at alarming rate until our shells. This time I know I'm bound to spit it back up. I didn't want this salty substitute. Just not going to do, I need some air. If I'm going to live through this.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dan Fagan, a professor of journalism and the director of the Master's Level Science, Health and Environmental Reporting Program at New York University, the former president of the Society of Environmental Journalists. He is the co-author of Toxic Deception, How the Chemical Industry Manipulates Science, Bends the Law, and Endangers Your Health. And he has just been awarded the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction for his new book, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Fagan.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And your book that just got the Pulitzer Prize is a story of midnight dumping and, I guess, deception in plain sight, and of corporate greed and government neglect, and also a group of extraordinarily courageous, dedicated people who stood up, refused to be silent, and eventually the truth was exposed. So let's begin with the villain, if you don't mind, in this story, which is the Siebert Corporation, a Swiss corporation that have been in this New Jersey shore region, the plants go back to World War II, don't they?
Oh, no, way before that. Let me first take a general issue with the way you phrase the question. Siebert is the name of the company, and to call them a villain would be not really phrasing in the right way. There are many reasons that things went wrong in Tom's River, and SIBA was certainly not the only source of difficulty. There was illegal dumping in Tom's River. There were lots of citizens who enjoyed the consequences of rapid growth that the industry brought and sort of willfully did not look ahead to the long-term consequences. The water company did a really poor job of protecting its citizens, and state regulators for many, many years really fell down on the job. So there's lots of blame to go around, and it's far too simplistic to just lay it at the feet of one particular company.
Even though they're the source of the pollution?
Well, they're not the only source. There was true that there was a very large chemical factory in town that was operated by SIBA starting in 1952. But there was also a really egregious illegal dump elsewhere in town that contaminated a different set of wells. And both of those Superfund sites, they would later become Superfund sites, were implicated in the health problems that ensued in Tom's River.
So in terms of the managers and the directors and the executives at SIBA, many of them were from Switzerland, right?
Somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Somewhere. And would they have gotten away with what they did in America, in Switzerland, do you think?
Well, again, that's a complex question that's phrased too simplistically. Mm-hmm. SIBA, you know, wound up spending hundreds of millions of dollars. SIBA and or its insurance company wound up spending a tremendous amount of money cleaning up the damage that had been done by that chemical plant. Beyond that, there were two different criminal prosecutions that eventually ended in civil settlements. And a couple of people from the company did indeed wind up pleading guilty. Beyond that, there was a legal negotiation. It wasn't actually a lawsuit, but it was a negotiation involving many of the affected families, 69 families of children who were either sickened or in some cases died from cancers that at least statistically had been associated with pollution in town. And SIBA, you know, was one of the defendants in that legal proceeding. So there were consequences. What I really want to focus on is the idea that, you know, what do we need to do from a prevention point of view to make sure that the Tom's River is the cautionary tale that it really should be? You know, we should be actively looking for these problems and dealing with them. we shouldn't be like the fire marshal, you know, waiting until the house burns down and then trying to figure out what caused the fire. We ought to be focusing on prevention, and there's a lot that we can do.
Again, I'm speaking with Dan Fagan, professor of journalism and the director of the Master's Level Science, Health and Environmental Reporting Program at New York University, the former president of the Society of Environmental Journalists. He's the co-author of Toxic Deception, How the Chemical Industry Manipulates Science, Bends the Law, and Endangers Your Health. And he has just been awarded the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction for his new book, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. But the heart of the story that you've uncovered and written about, Dan Fagan, is a sort of scientific detective story that tries to link cause and effect in terms of cancer clusters that erupted, affecting young children and obviously adults as well, but certainly manifesting themselves in very young people. And that's always been a difficult link to make, has it not? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. That's really the core of the book. It is a quite fascinating scientific detective story that, you know, in a sense has its roots, you know, from starting in classical times. People are trying to figure out the relationship between environmental exposure and chronic disease. It's a very complex problem, but also quite a fascinating one. And epidemiology is something that, you know, people are intimidated by. They think it's too complicated to understand, but it's really about pattern interpretation. It's about how do we interpret patterns. When we see things around us, we see a lot of cases that looks like there are too many cases of a particular kind of cancer or cancer in general. No, it alarms us. And so epidemiology, one of the most important contributions of epidemiology, is to try to figure out statistically through a whole series of steps whether what looks like a cluster is actually has a likely cause or whether it is just random. Because we know that things can cluster for no reason at all. When we see birds flying across the sky, they don't space themselves out evenly. Things cluster. The question is whether they cluster for a reason. It turns out that epidemiology can never tell us certainty about cause and effect, but it is a science of probability. And in other parts of our lives, we act on probability all the time. We can't expect environmental health to, you know, operate, you know, the same way that we would decide a criminal trial, you know, with evidence beyond the shadow of a doubt. Instead, we have to look at the preponderance of evidence, and epidemiology is really good for that. And if we do that, if we reckon. You know, if we accept the reality that we will never know for sure about what caused a particular case of cancer, say, for example, if we accept that reality but then go on to say, well, what do the probabilities tell us based on good science, good epidemiology? Well, we can really protect ourselves in ways that we're really not doing now.
Well, isn't one of the problems, though, and it also manifests itself over this unnecessary foot-dragging over global warming and climate change, that those that are either skeptical or are in outright denial want absolute scientific proof. And it's difficult to, you know, provide absolute scientific proof, even with overwhelming anecdotal information and evidence. And it would seem to me that is also at the heart of your story here, which is
It is. It's at the heart of virtually every interesting problem in science that we have. For some reason, you know, when we're living our lives, we routinely act based on probabilities without requiring certainty. And yet, for other kinds of situations, you know, often involving the environment and environmental risk, we say, well, let's not do anything. Let's not try to resolve this problem until we know for sure. And that is a standard that science can very rarely meet. That's a canard, really. That is not the way that we should be dealing with environmental policymaking. On the other hand, we can't assume that all risks are created equal and that just because something poses a small risk that it's something that we should change our lives about. We have to be smart about risk. Environmentalists, I'm proud to call myself an environmentalist, but we environmentalists have to be smart about risk also. I'm a journalist first, and journalists are trained, science journalists, are trained to follow the evidence. And those of us who are environmentalists also need to follow the evidence. And we should not assume that all risks are created equal. We should be smart about evaluating risks and looking at alternatives and making smart decisions where we can.
But surely, in a way, your story, Dan Fagan, the winner of the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation, in many ways, you know, there's a certain level of common sense as well. If you drink water that tastes weird and smells bad, that's your first clue, right? And it seems up like the first clue showed up even at the in the drinking founders at the very plant that we're talking about, the SIBA plant, because their water wells were the first to be contaminated. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I do think there's a lot to be said for following common sense. I don't think common sense can be the end of it. But common sense is a wonderful first recourse to say, this deserves further investigation. And certainly in Tom's River, especially in the early years, there was a lot of willful disregarding of common sense. And the reason is that people were enjoying the benefits of rapid growth. You know, for many years, Ocean County, New Jersey, where Tom's River is, was one of the fastest growing counties in the United States. And the real estate business was booming. People were making a lot of money, and those jobs at the chemical factory were wonderful middle-class jobs. You know, they were blue-collar jobs that paid well. And so there was a lot of sort of willful disregard of the long-term consequences of short-term actions. And, you know, that's eventually there was a reckoning.
Right, but normally we don't all make these kind of Faustian bargains, do we? We get a good job and a middle-class job, but by the way, your kids are getting cancer because the water is poisonous. I mean,
sure we do. Even in Tom's River, in retrospect, this all sounds very clean and easy. How could they possibly have ignored this evidence? But in the real world, it rarely works that way. Evidence sort of creeps up on us. It builds up over time. The state of the science was not nearly as good then as it is now, and it's going to be better 20 years from now than it is now. You know, now there are big debates underway about, say, you know, whether we should proceed with hydraulic fracturing, fracking, and to what extent should we do that, and what should the regulatory regime look like. And it's a difficult question, in part because natural gas, in some ways, is a very useful bridge fuel. I mean, if we had a rational energy policy, moving to decarbonize the energy system, personally, I would feel like, you know, using more natural gas, despite the many problems, you know, might be a sensible interim plan. We don't have a long-term strategy like that, so I don't think it makes sense. But the point that I'm trying to make is that everything looks clear in retrospect, and nothing ever looks obvious and clear while it's going on. And that's the case in Tom's River as well.
Well, but in the example that you gave, Dan Fagan, all of these things require somebody asking for or demanding a study. And in the case of fracking, still to this day, there's never been a comprehensive study of all of the leakage in the gas grid, all the way from the fracking fields and other fields through the distribution of gas and into the home itself. So
I think that's exactly right. And I think the people who make that point are making a very good point. And we need more data. Absolutely, we need more data. I'm not in any way saying that, you know, we should proceed full bore with fracking. Mm-hmm. In fact, since we don't have a sensible long-term strategy to decarbonize the economy, I do not favor fracking, period. The reason is that all we're really doing is postponing the inevitable hard decisions of you know, eliminating our addiction to fossil fuels, which we will have to do. It's just a question of when. But your point of look, we don't have good data on methane leakage and the extent of water contamination and also the tremendous amount of water that is required to frack wells. Yeah, we don't have good data. We need more data. All that I'm saying is that we never have enough data, and that the really hard decisions are what do we do with incomplete, in the absence of data, what kinds of decisions should we make? Environmentalists cite the precautionary principle, which is a very intelligent thing, in my opinion, but it is not the complete answer, because data will never be as complete as we would like it to do, as we would like it to be. There will never come a point when we know everything that we feel like we need to know to have perfect information about a particular action or particular environmental risk. The really hard decisions are all about figuring out what to do without complete information.
Well, I'm not an environmental reporter, but I do cover national security affairs. And years ago, when Ceausescu fell in Romania, I remember talking to a former one of the top people in their version of the KGB, the Securitate. And apparently, the Ceausescu and his wife would pore over the lists of all the dissidents in the country, and he would put a mark against certain names and write Radu, which means radiation. And what would happen is that individual would be called in by the secret police for an interview, and they'd sit in a waiting room for hours and hours to meet Colonel so-and-so. And then after several hours, a sort of sliding glass window would open, and somebody would say to the individual who'd been sitting there reading tattered magazines for hours and hours, obviously in a state of nervous tension, that you have to come back tomorrow. But all the while that they were sitting in that room, they were being radiated. So, and of course, Ceausescu and company were counting on the fact that nobody would make the connection between going to the secret police headquarters and ending up months or years later with terminal cancer. So that's, you know, the link between the cause and effect of cancer has, I'm not suggesting that SIBR is like Ceausescu, but it is a gray area that is clearly exploited.
Well, I don't know what you mean by exploited, but yeah. But I don't.
Well, it gives.
That's a horrible story about Ceausescu.
Right.
I mean, that's really evil. That kind of deliberate poisoning. That's not what happens in the cases that I'm writing about. What happens in the cases that I'm writing about is that companies do what companies do, which is that they try to maximize profits for their shareholders and increase their market share, and to do it as much as possible as they can within the constraints of the law. Occasionally, they go outside the constraints of the law. But even acting within the constraints of the law, there can eventually be terrible consequences. And that's what happened in this case. But it is certainly not the case that anybody set out to poison anybody else. That is not what's happened here. And I've been an environmental journalist for 25 plus years. And that is not the fact pattern. And I wouldn't want your listeners to somehow make that assumption.
No, and I certainly wouldn't want them either, because it's not the assumption, but it's the gray area that the heroes in your book had to fight, right? The nurses,
yeah,
the parents.
They said
kids are dying, but nobody would listen to them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if your point is that hey, it's very difficult to draw those lines between cause and effect, especially for a chronic disease like cancer, where you can have a latency period between the triggering exposure, you get a 5, 10, 15 years pass, sure, that makes it extremely difficult, and it makes it much harder for people to make their case, to reduce risk and to get the kind of social change that we need to make the world safer. So, yeah, if that's your point, I agree.
Well, in terms of that point then, just in closing, Dan Fagan, in terms of making the world safer, where do we stand? I mean, the head of the EPA was the governor of New Jersey, right, Christy Todd Whitman?
Well, she was not the head of EPA during most of the events described in the Toms River book. That actually occurred later.
Mm-hmm.
She was the governor of New Jersey during some key events that occurred in Toms River.
Right.
So in that sense, yes.
But in terms of her later tenure, has the EPA tightened up its rules, made it to, obviously the state regulators are the ones in this case that needed a wake-up call.
Yeah, that's right. But this is a much bigger problem than just Toms River. I mean, I would hate for your listeners to come away from this thinking, oh, you know, this is really just about poor Toms River and the negligent New Jersey government. I mean, the only thing that's unusual about Toms River is that we actually found out about it. And we found out about it only through a whole fluky series of events, and also, as you alluded to, the determination and bravery of these families. So this is not just about New Jersey state government or a particular governor. This is a problem much bigger than that. I mean, in this country right now, we have a very hollowed out regulatory system. We're trying to manage environmental risk using laws that are 40 years old. And the agencies that are trying to do it are drastically underfunded. You know, we have a kind of a ruling ideology in major parts of this country that says that government is somehow the enemy, and so let's defund it. And then, of course, when you defund regulatory agencies, people get frustrated and they say, see, government doesn't work. And then regulation loses even more public support. So it's a real vicious circle. And what we need is updated laws, robust regulation, and, you know, most of all, Ian, what we need is campaign finance reform, because this long stall that we're in terms of environmental regulation in this country is directly related to this unending stalemate in Congress. And that stalemate is in turn directly tied to the influence of special interest dollars in Washington and also in state capitals. We've got to reduce the influence of special interest money in the system if we want to have any hope of intelligently addressing, collectively addressing, these very serious issues, whether we're talking about hazardous chemical exposures like what happened in Toms River and in many other communities, or whether we're talking about addressing global climate change, which is a collective problem that demands a collective response.
Well, Dan Fagan, I thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure being with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dan Fagan, who's a professor of journalism and the director of the Master's Level Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program at New York University, the former president of the Society of Environmental Journalists. He is the co-author of Toxic Deception, How the Chemical Industry Manipulates Science, Bends the Law, and Endangers Your Health. And he has just been awarded the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction for his new book, Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.